All right. Thank you all. We're going to move now to number two, open public comments. One of the things that we tried to do over in Spokane, because we had a lot of a very, very interesting comments from the public, and we devoted a lot of time to it, and it was really, really important. So we went from two to three. So I'm going to call you folks up three at a time. We have three chairs. We only have two mics, but we'll make that work. Everybody knows it's 3 minutes. Tammy will... We'll let you know when you're done. Please finish your sentence. And so here we go. Dennis DeSilva, thank you for coming. We didn't see you in Spokane. Bruce Vandervoort and Jesse Pecor.
Chair Carpenter, members of the commission, Director Siswind, and Deputy Director Storr. I'm Dennis DeSilva, Chair of the WDFW's Wildlife Diversity Advisory Council, the WDAC. Maybe some of you don't know what the WDAC does, so I'll state it before I go into the rest of my spiel. We advise the WDFW on keeping common species common, on recovering sensitive, threatened, or endangered species, and on developing approaches for building public support for wildlife diversity management. Building public support. I'd like you to keep those three words in mind as I spiel on. Last January, Lands Manager Cynthia Wilkerson presented the Lands Showcase work to you. I liked that so much that I asked her to present it to the WDAC in our last March meeting. I was delighted that she has further developed the showcase. There's a final version of that. I think she put it out to the executive team. In fact, the WDAC members were unanimous in agreeing we liked the messaging put forth in her updated presentation. To this end, we recommend the WDFW adopt this messaging throughout the agency. In addition, yesterday, while listening to the WDFW's new public affairs guru, Carrie McCausland, at the Big Tent meeting, I was struck by how far the idea of outreach to the non-traditional WDFW audience has come since that misdirected, that's my word, misdirected, marketing presentation to the commission in October 2017. After that October meeting, I received an email from the marketing folks stating that a new marketing plan was going to be released on April 1st, 2018. April 1st. I should have guessed by the date that this was a joke. But given what I've seen from Cynthia Wilkerson's work and from what I heard from Carrie McCausland, I'm hoping that there's room in the WDFW's marketing plan for outreach and proactive messaging well beyond that of the traditional hunting and fishing communities in our state. I look forward to seeing some real product and real progress in letting all Washingtonians know of and hopefully appreciate the work of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Bruce?
Good morning. I'm president of the Washington State Trappers Association. I speak for about 500 Washington trappers. I want to address agenda item number 6 and more specifically proposed changes to WAC 220-417-030. I did not find out about this until about 2 weeks ago and had no opportunity to comment. I will note that there is no time on the agenda for comment on that particular item, so I'm here now. I have to say I was pretty upset the department did not reach out to the Trappers Association for changes in a law so very critical to trappers. I did fire off a letter to the director and subsequently spoke with Eric Gardner and Anissa Oud. They promised me they would ask for the changes to be withdrawn until such time as we have a chance to discuss our concerns. I would hope any mistakes made with the process will have a positive effect. by reinforcing how important it is for the department to work with various user groups. That being said, I want to make clear why we are so opposed to changes in the wording of WAC 2017-030. The proposed changes would change the law so that restraining traps would have to be checked every 24 hours as opposed to removing any animals within 24 hours. This wording would allow no leeway for unexpected circumstances. Currently, we have enough leeway to check traps at different times of the day. With this change, we would have to check traps at the same time or earlier every day. So if I set 10 traps one day, I have to hit those traps at the same time or earlier every day. If I get delayed, I would be in violation of the law. If I wake up one morning and we have an ice storm, or the roads are slippery with snow, or maybe there is a huge traffic jam, I might want to put off going out for a few hours until the roads are safe. But no, I would be in violation of the law. Trappers could be the only user group required to risk our lives in order to comply with the law. The way the law is currently written gives us enough leeway so that we can check traps at different times of the day without fear of arrest. Also, I have a fear trappers could be ticketed because it might not always be obvious when trappers are checking their traps. We have a real problem with trap theft and vandalism. Especially in the snow, trappers often don't closely approach traps to avoid leaving a trail anyone can follow. It might seem a trapper is not visiting every day when they might in fact be checking with binoculars or some other device that allows a sprung trap to be seen from a distance. I guess I'm out of time, so I will.
Thank you. Do staff like to comment on now or later?
Staff request.
1 second, Kim.
So Bruce is exactly right. You're going to hear later in the day that our recommendation is going to be to withhold making any changes to that WAC so that we can have these conversations.
Very good.
So this was one of the issues that came up in the Wildlife Committee meeting, and I asked if we were going to thank you for testifying, if we were going to have somebody here, not allowing him to speak in the Wildlife Committee meeting because we had a lot of business, but I would be interested to hear what is common practice in terms of setting traps and checking traps and all that.
Well, you're going to check your traps every day, but it's the time. Now, the wording that has been proposed is, it's in a lot of states, and it causes trappers a lot of problems because there's that, you know, you have to check those traps at that certain time or earlier every day. And like I said, it's now with the current wording, which I might add, the trappers proposed that about 20 years ago as opposed to a 72-hour trap check. So we encourage the trap check time to be shortened. But it allows us to just check traps once a day and doesn't make us, a particular time of the day when we have to check them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jesse?
Good morning, Chairman Carpenter, members of the Commission, Director Suswind, and Deputy Director Storr. My name is Jesse Pecor. I'm a member of the Stillaguamish Tribe. Member of the Stillaguamish Tribe of Indians in Arlington. I'm also the Vice Chair of the Hunting, Fishing, and Gathering Committee for the Tribe, and I'm currently in the role of Wildlife Policy Lead for the Tribe. I'm here representing our hunting membership, and I would just like to take a moment to thank the department for all the work that they do with the Skagit elk. And the main reason that I'm here is because of a resolution passed on April 2nd by the Skagit County Commissioners. And you may or may not have heard about that yet. We did receive notification that it will likely be presented to you if it hasn't been already. And the tribes would really like to just urge the commission to maintain the process that we're going through with co-management, and we would like to really push the emphasis on how important our treaty rights are in that area. We understand that there is an impact to agriculture and the folks that live in the area. We also feel as though the department and the tribes have been working together over the last few years, diligently trying to relieve some of that pressure off of the agriculture folks. We believe that we have a method that we're experimenting with starting this year, of changing things up and kind of identifying certain specific areas of high concern and dealing with them that way rather than just sending out a ton of permits. We've seen in the past that just killing elk doesn't work. We believe that if the department or the commission did issue the substantial increase in damage permits on the valley floor, that it would impact treaty rights at a high level for not just the Stillaguamish tribe, but all 9 Treaty of Point Elliott signatory tribes. So the basis of the Skagit County Commissioner's resolution was based on a level of facts that were known to be untrue by both the department and the tribes. I have a fact sheet that the WDFW staff had put together and had it vetted through the tribes, and if you would like to see it, I can bring it to you. I brought enough copies for everybody. And it just kind of settles some of the untruths or unknown facts around the Skagit County elk issue and the North Cascades elk herd as a whole. Thank you.
Go ahead, Commissioner Graybill.
You mentioned that you have a new approach that you're going to try this year.
Yes.
Could you specify that, explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so the WDFW and the tribes have been looking at utilizing a new method of the same approach, so to speak. So it's not any different. There's hazing, there's lethal removal, and there's other mitigation efforts also. We're looking at a method called subgroup management that was originally presented to WDFW by the Stillaguamish tribe, our biologist Jen 70, and it is now being looked at through a subcommittee formed within the Treaty of Point Elliott ceded territory. It has members of WDFW and 8 of the 9 tribes on it, and it's known as the Adaptive Management Committee. And what we're doing is we're picking certain groups of elk that are large enough to sustain larger harvests in conflict areas that are higher conflict than some places, because currently the method is to issue a landowner permit and then send a hunter out anywhere within that area and target any elk. And we've seen that that is unsuccessful and doesn't really do anything for the damage complaints level. So we're targeting specific groups within specific areas that are high conflict.
Mr. Holzmiller.
So have you done anything? Or are you just looking at this and talking yet?
So currently we had our first meeting where we discussed options of how we move forward. Obviously, as from a co-manager standpoint, the herd health is a large impact on what we do and how we act.
Yes or no? Are you doing something or are you still just talking?
To this date, WDFW, I believe, has had a small focus group of trying the new method, but we haven't done it across the entire 4941 yet, no.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you.
Did you want the fact sheet? Sorry.
Give them to Tammy over here if you'd be kind enough, please.
Thank you.
Dale Sharp, Martha Jordan, and Dave Duncan. Dale, go ahead, please.
Chairman Carpenter, Director, Deputy Director, Commission. My name is Dale Sharp, and I've been a traditional only bow hunter since age 12. And in the past,
I served as president of Traditional Bowhunters of Washington for about 12 years. Most other states may not have had responsible bow hunters working with wildlife departments to establish reasonable equipment rules. Oh, some arguments have been made for eliminating the minimum arrow weight. Those who did that groundwork put the animals first, wanting effective rules that ensured fast kills. I was at the table with the three statewide organizations about 20 years ago when some concessions came as a response to the claim that women and children couldn't get good arrow flight out of a 400 grain arrow. In the midnight hour, the agreed upon 350 minimum concession was changed to 6 grains per pound and 300 grains, which brings us to why 6 grains per pound. And the answer is safety. The compound bow manufacturer's warranties state that damage to a compound because of an arrow shot at less than X number of grains per pound is an unsafe condition, and they will not warrant that bow. Bowtech's warranty on a 2019 model, I just researched, the Redhead, it's called, says that it's 5 grains per pound. That's the minimum. That's 200 grain arrow out of a 40-pound bow. Bowtech's safety portion of their user's manual says, quote, without the resistance of a properly weighted arrow to absorb the energy, you may damage the compound, I use that word, not them, and cause personal injury to yourself or others. The pioneers of bow hunting, they knew that a wood bow could explode if a reasonably weighted arrow wasn't allowed to absorb that energy, and nothing has changed with the advent of the mechanical arrow flinging device, so popular now. For the sake of safety, just instruct enforcement to keep their pocket grain scales and leave the minimum arrow weight where it is, if not increase it to 350. Dr. Ed Ashby, by the way, someone said there's no studies, has almost 20 years of research that has clearly demonstrated that heavy arrows are more effective on game animals. They have more efficacy in the producing those desired results. Physics. It's all about an object in motion, stays in motion, and the heavier that object, the further it's going to go before it comes to a rest. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the department's work in all the good things you do.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martha.
I'm Martha Jordan with the Northwest Swan Conservation Association. I'm just giving you a swan update for this year. I'm giving you a handout that has the midwinter swan survey results from the third week in January when we count pretty much the North counties. It does not include a lot of the counties where we have swans because it's not the five-year survey, which is more comprehensive, but this is where the vast majority of our birds are. You can see that we had basically a total of 17,329 swans. Most of them are trumpeter in this northwest area with about 1,800 or so tundra swans. Most of them are in Skagit County. You can read the document, but this gives you some graphs and stuff. And this was prepared by Daniel Zimmerman from all the data, from all the volunteers and the Canadian Wildlife Service input. But Daniel is our swan lead. So if you have any questions about this, let me know. Most of my time, I want to talk about the swan mortality report, which is on the other side of your sheet. We've been working on swan mortality, obviously, a lot of you know, since the early 2000s, 1999, when we started having a huge die-off up at the border in Whatcom County and Sumas Prairie. Most of that mortality has been mitigated, and we're still working on it. However, this year, we do have power line collisions, which happen. So this chart here that I provided you really breaks down the mortality, which also includes Clallam County, where we're now building a population of swans in the wintertime. And the Audubon Society has really taken a super interest, and we have a project kind of between the department, ourselves, and the Audubon to look at those swans, because occasionally we have mortality there, but also the population is building. And this year we had $80,000 worth of damage to an organic farmer after the freeze when they discovered his broccoli and cauliflower. So that was kind of a blindsided one there. But in terms of the mortality, you can see that just in the chart, 389 as of the end of the reporting season, which is basically April 1st. However, I want to really emphasize that we have had three mortality events this year. The first one began in Whatcom County. Typically, birds come down. They hit Judson Lake this year, and for whatever reason, we still are discussing it, 100 and something. I mean, they found a lot of birds at Judson Lake in the very beginning of the season, and then the mortality went back to its kind of normal background level. Then again, this year, for the second year, we had a die-off at Lake Taps down by Pierce County at the lake. It was very quick and seemed to be contained to 13 to 15 swans. And this year, to say really great, but Region 6 took it over. But more importantly, and I know my 3 minutes is up, Crescent Lake area, Monroe, at the wildlife area, we had a die-off starting, I found it, March 16th. And now we're up to 60 birds and counting. It's not over yet. We're still out there picking them up. This is a significant die-off. It has caught us all by complete surprise. And it is, with the exception of one bird, which I know is a power line collision, it appears to be all lead shot ingestion. This is only 4 years after the 2015 die-off. So we're very concerned. And the agency is, we're working as a team. So I just want to say that.
Thank you very much. Keep those in the loop. Mr. Duncan.
Good morning, Chairman Carpenter, ladies and gentlemen of the Commission, Director Suswan, and Deputy Director Storr. My name is Dave Duncan. I reside at 4636 Weaver Road in Ellensburg, Washington. In reading today's agenda, I see where Director Suswan will be doing a cougar update, and I quote, on constituent concerns about cougar predation impacting deer and elk herds in vast WDFW to reduce cougar populations in some parts of the state through increased hunting. I'm quite sure this valid concern was partly a result of the testimony at the Spokane Commissioners meeting. I travel here today to make my position, along with the organizations that I represent, positions clear on this issue. The present cougar management policy is fundamentally flawed. Its high density of cougars are having a large negative impact on ungulate populations statewide, and the present policy is not sustainable even on livestock landscapes not yet containing wolves or their added needs. I'm handing in a position paper on the subject for your reading enjoyment. We are not looking for a one-time fix or a change to hunting regulations to resolve this issue. We have never advocated for the use of hunting as a preferred tool to control predator populations. The department should have the full suite of tools available to them and then choose the appropriate tool or tools needed to perform their duties as wildlife managers and public servants. In this case, the selection of which tool to use is a social and or economic issue, not a wildlife management issue, in our opinion. Our position has never varied on predator-prey management in more than a decade, and it is as follows. The department needs to implement a comprehensive predator-prey management system statewide that is integrated. Ungulates and predators cannot be managed separately from each other. These guidelines need to protect ungulate populations with the ultimate goal of maintaining ungulate populations, including calf and fawn recruitment, at management objectives. Integrating a comprehensive predator-prey management system will ultimately prove beneficial to predators and ungulate populations. Science says that ignoring the predator-prey relationship and the impact of predation on ungulates in a multi-apex predator ecosystem is disastrous to ungulates and predator populations. Do something before it's too late. I will close with one question. Why are predators presently exempt from basic wildlife management concepts in Washington State? Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you all. The last three this morning are, pardon me, Sarah Ryan, Nick Babbage, and Brian Beckman. Sarah, please.
Good morning, Chairman Carpenter, members of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Director Suswin, and Deputy Director Storr. I am Sarah Ryan, the Executive Vice President for the Washington Cattlemen's Association. I'm here to offer comments. In Spokane, I think you heard a lot about the challenges with predators and ungulates, and so just kind of following up on that, from a cattleman's perspective, I think one of the best non-lethal deterrents for predators and livestock interaction is to have a robust ungulate population. So as you're contemplating what to do about predators, making sure they have enough to eat so that livestock isn't their choice would probably work really well. Our members are about to turn out on public lands for the 2019 grazing season. I will be remiss and in trouble if I don't mention that predators seem to still bother livestock even when they're on private land. But since we tend to focus more on what happens on public lands, we need some kind of protocol for wolf-livestock interaction going into the 2019 season. And I would encourage you as the commission, the department, and WAG to consider a more flexible program, something that allows the department to work with local ranchers, because frankly, the local ranchers know which wolves are actually causing the problem, to come in and take a targeted approach if there needs to be lethal removal, so that the behavior of the pack should change more rapidly than just picking off the first one that can be found in that pack. Would also encourage just to build trust. I think that needs to happen between the department and local ranchers and the rural communities. The opportunity just to engage in conversation and not this like, oh, I'm better than you, I'm better than you. And I'm not saying that as ranchers we don't have that to work on as well, but just open more conversation instead of this kind of a territory battle. So I would encourage you as the commission, as you're looking at what to do with predator populations and managing them, to really address the ungulate population or the lack thereof in the areas where we've seen a lot of depredation. And it's really not your issue, but so you know, in case you didn't notice, like February and March, we had an incredibly late, very, very bad winter. Most cattlemen have adjusted their calving such that it happens in that time because generally winter hits earlier. So our members have been more hit than normal, and I'm genuinely concerned that one more thing, be it a depredation or whatever, is going to be too much. And that's all I have. So thank you for listening.
Mr. Holzmiller.
And I guess just more of a comment than anything, depends upon the area you're at. In our part of the world, the vast majority of the cattle are run on private property, not public. And there again, it's, you can't distinguish between the two, but it is a predator issue all around. And we won't be careful about distinguishing between public and private because it's all in the same. So, and Sarah's right. This was a wreck this winter, and everybody's going to be holding on by the skin of their teeth at best.
At best.
So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Nick?
Hey, good morning, Director Suswin, Vice Chairman, Commissioner, Deputy Director. I'm Nick Babbage, President of PSVOA, third generation purse seiner, or hopefully not the last, but I'm here to testify about the ongoing North of Falcon negotiations, mainly the negotiations between the department and the tribes concerning the Puget Sound commercial chum fishery. We were informed just lately that the tribes are focused on limiting our fishing opportunities mainly in the South Puget Sound area. We are deeply concerned about the outcome of these discussions. PSVOA has been committed to working with the department to find long-term solutions to the Puget Sound chum fishery that will benefit all. PSVOA has been committed to creating more fish for all to benefit from funding hatcheries after the budget cuts. I was on the board then, and I was a reluctant yes vote to go ahead with the funding the way the fishery has seemed to be going. And as a board member, we have fiduciary duties to spend our money wisely. The chum fishery is the last fishery that we actually can participate in. We can't fish for silvers. We can't fish for kings. So I think the tribes know that if they can limit us on our chum fishery, that we will no longer be participating in any fishery in Washington. And I was nervous when we started to fund these hatcheries and take them over. It's in our DNA as a fisherman to create more fish. So we think we're awesome stewards of the land. But it's to me, and I think a lot of other people on the board, it seems like it became somewhat of a tribal fishery instead of a state fishery. And we would like to see it become a state fishery where the tribes and the non-treaty all fish in common. Meanwhile, the tribes continue to fish in Area 9, an area that a lot of the money we spent in McKernan and other places was to create more fish in Hood's Canal. But they continue to fish in Area 9, not to count those fish against the tribal share in Hood's Canal, which has consistently exceeded the share in Area 9. It's a clear violation of the court-approved Puget Sound Management Plan that we thought would take care of that issue. We, as PSVOA, and hopefully the department, are hoping the department will act on behalf of PSVOA and the entire non-treaty commercial fishing fleet in achieving a fair and equitable outcome in the 2019 North of Falcon meetings. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe not a question, but it perked my ears when you mentioned this is the last fishery, the chum fishery is the last fishery for the purse seine industry in Puget Sound, and there was some fear about what that meant. And you started off by saying you're a multi-generational fisherman. So the topic here is North of Falcon. These are ongoing negotiations. There have been some rumors that have floated out of those that there may have been some concern about eliminating the purse seine fishery. And so at least speaking as one commissioner who is cognizant of the commission's mandate to maintain and enhance the sport and commercial fisheries of the state, that at least I do think the purse seine fishery is a very important fishery to the state. There's a long history and culture there that's very important to the state. And it would be very disappointing if, as a result of these negotiations, this extreme rumor that has been put out there would ever come to pass. It would be very, very disappointing if that did.
I really appreciate your comments, and that's good to hear. And that we are nervous, and it seems like we're kind of the low-hanging fruit, and we're the ones that take the brunt, and I appreciate your comments.
Brian Beckman, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair, Commissioners, Director Susswind, and Deputy Director Storr. My name is Brian Bankman. I'm also representing Puget Sound Vessel Owners Association, and I'm here about the North of Falcon negotiations as well. I've been fishing for 35 years, longer than that if you count my crew time. I'm also representing people like Nick and other guys that are multi-generational fishermen here. And for the last 5 years, the fishery seems like it's been changed to our disadvantage. And it started about 5 years ago when we lost a day of fishing in our schedule. It changed how they calculate the run size in Hood Canal to our detriment. I know the department has recognized that. In fact, I testified here a couple of years ago about that. And the tribes have refused to really acknowledge the change because it's to their benefit to leave it alone. And then 3 years ago, they started fishing in Area 9. That fishery's grown every year. There's been no accounting for it in terms of the allocation or where those fish are, you know, accounted in the sharing arrangement. I feel like this year they've made this new proposal threatening to get rid of seines in South Sound. I think it's a distraction. They don't even talk about Area 9. They don't want to talk about Hood Canal. They want, no, we'll put that aside. We got what we want there. Now we want to talk about, throw the focus somewhere else. And I know that the staff, and when I talk to them in the department, they kind of agree with me. They see what's going on, but they feel kind of toothless. It's like there's unilateral management. It's not co-management anymore. And so I'm just here to ask you to direct the department to please be steadfast in the negotiations and stand our ground and not allow us to keep getting steamrolled here. Thank you.
I born in Mount Vernon, grew up in South Bellingham amongst all the Vuhovicis and the Saners there, so I'm very familiar with what you do, and I was on one when I was 6 years old, and it's a very honorable profession. Not to dwell on what you gentlemen said, you made some very compelling comments. What's your view of how we go forward to improve relationships and with that opportunity? When I say that, do you have any perspective or thoughts on what we could do to engage with the tribes and get your message across and the culture that you come from? Because we have to be respectful of theirs, certainly, but from your culture, and what we could do collectively to make the pie bigger so everybody has a chance and we're not kind of struggling over the last school of fish that comes by. I know you guys have done a lot in your organization, but going forward from this point, do you have any thoughts, any vision for the future?
Well, we have helped with hatchery development or maintenance and improvement in Hood Canal. In fact, the whole change in schedule 5 years ago was because in 2013 there was such a huge run that the non-treaty fishery caught so many fish that processors were swamped. And the tribal fishery couldn't really market their fish that week. And that was what precipitated eliminating a day in that peak week of the fishery. So it wasn't fighting over the last fish. It's fighting over a fairly robust resource, especially in Hood Canal. But it's how that pie is getting divided that has been changing.
I think we'd be interested in talking more about this and hearing more in the future. I just have one question. Do you have any young people in your fleet, or do they all look like us with gray hair?
We do have young people. Yes.
How young?
Oh, guys in their 30s that are starting up.
Good for you.
Yeah,
Thank you for
encouraging because I'm about to retire.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Perhaps you guys can answer this, or somebody in the room. As I recall, we had presentations some months ago from Recovery Board managers, and the Hood Canal Recovery Board, I thought CHUM was a huge, my recollection was CHUM was a huge success in Hood Canal. Do you recall that present? Isn't that true? So this is not a conservation issue.
If I may, Kim, this discussion ongoing now is not about Hood Canal. It's about South Sound.
No, I understand that, but it seems like it links into, at least as I'm hearing it, it links into the allocation in Hood Canal as well. So I guess I'm just... my thinking is it's really all about allocation and not so much about conservation.
I think that Area 9 that has been discussed here, that's an allocation problem that the tribes have now started fishing. So how do you allocate a fish that could be going to South Sound or it could be going to Hood's Canal? And it's an area they shouldn't be fishing. It's an area they don't want to count as their fish. So those could be South Sound fish, they could be Hood's Canal fish, but them in that area has really become a thorn in the department's side and ours, because they're going to claim there's no fish in South Sound when they're fishing where they really shouldn't be fishing. And I think when you said earlier, how can we make it better? And I think if we both felt, or the non-treaty and treaty fishermen, if we were playing by the same rules, I think it'd be a lot easier to manage. And we have to obey the rules. And I think if it's arrogance or they get away with something, they'll try it again. But we're not playing by the same rules, so you can't manage it as a 50-50. So I think we would hope, and we'd like to come together, because it's they have heritage, we have heritage. But without, if we're not playing by the same set of rules, it's be impossible to manage. And that's what we're asking for. And it seems like we keep obeying, they ask for more and don't obey. And it's not us against them, it shouldn't be, but that's what it's becoming.
Mr. Kehoe.
Yeah. Thank you. Of course, everybody knows how important this issue is to me, and I thank Nick and Brian for coming this morning and highlighting the importance of this. You know, there's no doubt about it. This is a very, all North of Falcon negotiations are difficult. This one is particularly difficult for the commercial fleet, in that it seems like the fishery is the focus, the target. And I am optimistic. I mean, once we overcome this hurdle, and Purse Seine Vessel Owners has, as both of these gentlemen have pointed out, I mean, we have worked together with the tribes, particularly in Hood Canal. When we worked with the Skokomish tribe, Port Gamble, we worked collectively also in the legislature to restore funding for that chum hatchery. So we have a good history. And years ago, too, I recall, we worked with the Puyallup tribe when there were reductions in another chum hatchery. There's two gentlemen that aren't here that also live in the Gig Harbor area that have worked every year to and volunteered at Minter to recover eggs and so. You know, I think I would encourage the director I'd like you to maybe close up the discussion. To clearly let the tribes know that we're willing to work together. I think and should, and it's and I think some of the challenges in South Sound could be addressed. In terms of, in not just by reduction in fishery, but help in terms of enhancement, and we're very we meaning Purse Seine Vessel Owners would be very willing to work in the legislature to do what we can to go together with these folks, but we just need to overcome. Kind of the obstacles, and try to get them to recognize that we have fundamental issues with the fishery as well, and acknowledge that. So, but in any event, maybe Director, if you could just comment on kind of how you see this.
Sure. I will also cover a little bit more generally North of Falcon in the director's report. It's probably been I have a new hardest thing I've done since I've been director now with North of Falcon. I understand it's hard every year. I hope this is an exceptionally hard year, because it's been tough. The focus has been on chum, and there certainly was some talk of getting Purse Seiners off the water. We made it clear to folks that's a non-starter for us. That talk has not occurred since we started, so I'm hoping it was just an opening positionary statement. I'm absolutely confident we will have a Purse Seine fishing season this year. The real challenge to me, being new to it, we are still managing on this year-to-year thing, and that's what really needs to change. I think there's commitment on both sides, tribal and state, to develop a more comprehensive chum management plan for Puget Sound that would include Marine Area 9, would include Hood Canal. We've got catch imbalances in Hood Canal, as you're well aware of. We have other catch imbalances in South Sound. All that needs to be rolled up on what really works for folks and how do we really both meet our requirements under the treaties and case law. I think there's a commitment to do that, but that's not a short process. That's 3 to 5 years probably. So we need to be figuring out what we're doing in the interim. And we are. I will agree with Commissioner Kehoe. I can't speak from history, obviously, but our staff can, and the vessel owners have been incredible partners. They save chum production at our hatcheries, and they still show up every year. They don't need to, but they do because they care. So this really isn't a conservation issue. It is. I want to be careful. Tribes are concerned that we have runs, rivers that are not meeting escapement. So we collectively need to fix that. But there are a lot of fish out there, as you said. The runs are fairly healthy. So how do we go about making sure we get more escapement in those rivers? We're willing to work with, obviously, with our commissioners, our bosses, with the Persane Vessel Owners Association. If it takes legislation, we're willing to work with tribes. We've talked to them about, you know, when fish show up at hatcheries, if we're not having the fish up on the spawning grounds, DFW could show up and truck and get those fish to the spawning grounds. There are other ways to deal with this, but right now we're just hung up in that allocation issue. I sent a text because I was not there yesterday, and I know there was some further discussion around chum, so I'm at one day out of date, which is a lifetime in north of Falcon. But we had proposals, I think, that I didn't think we were far off a couple days ago that did have a hopefully acceptable outcome for the Persainers. So I understand the value of the fishery. We are committed to maintaining the fishery. And we are keeping our eye on the long game as well. We need to get through this year and next year, but we really see the solution in the longer term, and we will continue to work on that. We'll keep it in mind, and I hope you'll keep working with us.
Thank you, Director. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in. Appreciate your comments. I'd like to thank all the members of the public that came forward under open public comment. There's some good discussion.